Today is Thursday, April 9th, and this is the World Socialist Website. Amid deep divisions over ceasefire agreement, Israel launches massive attack on Lebanon, by Andre Damon. Within just one day, the two-week ceasefire with Iran, announced by Trump Tuesday night, is already falling apart, amid ongoing bombardments across the Middle East and an intensifying internal crisis within the United States itself. Sharp divisions have opened up within the ruling class and state apparatus over how to proceed after a war that has not achieved its aims. The entire situation raises the urgent imperative for workers not to rely on hopes for some sort of peaceful resolution to the imperialist war against Iran, but to develop an independent mass anti-war movement. Even what was agreed to as the basis of the ceasefire is itself entirely unclear and disputed. Just hours after the deal was announced, Israel carried out a massive bombardment of Lebanon Wednesday. It was the single deadliest day of Israeli attacks on the country since 2006. At least 254 people were killed and more than 1,100 wounded, including 35 children. Israeli jets struck apartment buildings, residential streets, and crowded commercial areas across central Beirut and the southern suburbs. The ceasefire between the U.S. and Iran was first announced by Pakistani Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif, who brokered the agreement. In his announcement Tuesday evening, Sharif declared that the United States and Iran, quote, along with their allies, have agreed to an immediate ceasefire everywhere, including Lebanon and elsewhere. On Wednesday, the Speaker of Iran's parliament, Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, accused the United States of violating the ceasefire by continuing to attack Lebanon through its Israeli ally, writing, quote, in such a situation, a bilateral ceasefire or negotiations is unreasonable. Israel asserts that Lebanon was not covered by the agreement, a claim that both Trump and White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt backed on Wednesday, with Trump referring to it as a quote-unquote separate skirmish. There are indications that Israel carried out the attack on Lebanon to sabotage the U.S.-Iran ceasefire agreement. The Wall Street Journal published an article Wednesday under the headline, Israel was informed late about ceasefire deal and wasn't happy, reporting that Israel, quote, wasn't formally part of the Iran negotiations. Israel, however, would not have launched an attack on this scale without the support of significant factions within the U.S. political establishment. Within the United States, criticism from the political establishment, both Democratic and Republican, has centered on condemnations of Trump's ceasefire announcement as a debacle for American imperialism and a dangerous and unacceptable concession to the Iranians. David Sanger, the senior national security correspondent for the New York Times, wrote Wednesday that the ceasefire, quote, resolved none of the fundamental issues that led to the war. Sanger quoted Richard Fontaine of the Center for a New American Security, who declared that, quote, Iran remains in control of the strait, and that it is, quote, hard to believe that the United States and the world could accept a situation in which Iran remains in control of a key energy checkpoint indefinitely. That would be a materially worse outcome than existed before the war, unquote. The Wall Street Journal editorial board published a statement Wednesday titled, Trump Declares Premature Victory in Iran, arguing that the, quote, Iranian regime remains a threat in the Strait of Hormuz, and the job is far from finished, unquote. The journal criticized Trump's, quote, inconsistent rhetoric on the war, and concluded, quote, the next test for Mr. Trump will be whether he takes his two-week ceasefire deadline seriously. If he does, and Iran plays its usual games, then he really will have to finish the job, unquote. Washington Post columnist Max Boot wrote Wednesday that Iran, quote, remains able to control, at least for now, which ships transit the Strait of Hormuz, which it was not doing when this war began. The Democrats, who just days ago warned of World War III, accused Trump of war crimes, and warned that soldiers who carry out his orders will be prosecuted under the laws of war, are shifting the tone of their criticisms. Not that Trump went too far, but that he sold out the crown jewels, and that he is treating U.S. imperialist policy as a New York real estate deal. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy told CNN Wednesday, quote, "But if Iran has the strait permanently now, then what? What an error. What a miscalculation this entire endeavor was," unquote. From the standpoint of the Trump administration, a ceasefire means nothing. Every ceasefire proclaimed by Trump in the Middle East has functioned as the prelude to further bloody military action. The June 2025 ceasefire that followed Operation Midnight Hammer, the B-2 bombing of Iran's nuclear facilities, was followed within 8 months by the full-scale war that began on February 28th. The strategic objectives of the United States have not changed. Washington launched this war to impose direct control over the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz and reverse the consequences of the 1979 Iranian Revolution. War against Iran is itself part of an escalating global war, one that extends from the Middle East to the confrontation with Russia and China, and the pressure for renewed military escalation will intensify. The entire experience of the past 2 weeks must be understood as an enormous warning to the working class in the United States and internationally. Just 24 hours ago, Trump was pledging to end Iranian civilization, threatening to transfer the methods of the Gaza genocide to a country of 90 million people. Trump's genocidal language cannot be unsaid, and genocide has been officially adopted as a method of conducting war by an American president. By resorting to Hitlerian rhetoric and threats of civilizational destruction, Trump has shattered the last remnants of the propaganda that U.S. imperialist interventions are carried out in the name of human rights or democracy. The world has been shown that the United States is led by a criminal oligarchy that treats entire societies as expendable obstacles to be smashed into submission. The only way to stop this war is through the independent mobilization of the working class as a class force. Neither the Democratic Party nor any faction of the political establishment will oppose imperialist war in principle. Whatever their tactical disputes with Trump, the Democrats defend the same strategic aims, U.S. domination of the Middle East, and function above all to suppress the emergence of a movement from below that threatens the entire structure of capitalist rule. The fight against imperialist barbarism requires the development of an independent working class movement in workplaces, across industries, and across borders, against the war, against the assault on social programs, and against the capitalist system that is the root cause of war, dictatorship, and social inequality. As election losses mount, the White House pursues ballot rigging plans, by Patrick Martin. Special elections in Georgia and Wisconsin Tuesday continued the pattern that has prevailed throughout the second Trump administration, a collapse of political support for the Republican Party, despite the failure of the Democratic Party to offer any genuine alternative to Trump's policies of war, economic austerity, and attacks on democratic rights. The results gave further impetus to Trump's efforts to prevent a landslide defeat in the midterm elections November 3rd through voter intimidation, blocking access to the ballot for poor and minority voters, and deploying his ICE immigration Gestapo and even the U.S. military at the polls. Both of Tuesday's elections took place in the shadow of the U.S. war with Iran, which has already had disastrous effects on the U.S. economy, and particularly on the living standards of the working class, with the price of gasoline jumping more than a dollar a gallon since Trump ordered massive bombing to begin on February 28th. Trump's approval rating in national surveys has sunk below 40%. The most recent figures showed him at 41% in Wisconsin and 38% in Georgia, the two states where voting took place Tuesday. Voter turnout was far lower than in the immediately preceding elections. In Wisconsin, total turnout fell from 2.36 million in 2025 to 1.5 million, a drop of 850,000. This disproportionately affected the Republican candidate, Maria Lazar, who received 600,000 votes, 460,000 fewer than last year's defeated Republican, Brad Schimmel. The Democratic vote also fell, but not as sharply. Winning candidate Chris Taylor received 905,000 votes, down 396,000 from the 1.3 million won by Susan Crawford last year. As a consequence, the Democratic margin widened from 10 percentage points, from 55 to 45, to 20 percentage points, 60 to 40. Taylor's margin of more than 300,000 votes was a comparative landslide in a state that has been closely contested in the last three presidential elections. Trump won the state by 23,000 votes in 2016, lost it by 21,000 in 20, and won it by 31,000 in 2024. Voter turnout was increased last year by two factors. It was the first opportunity for the electorate to show its opposition to Trump. Elon Musk, the world's richest man, also sought to buy control of the state's highest court, pumping nearly $20 million into the coffers of the Republican candidate, a record for a state judicial election, nominally nonpartisan. The election in Georgia, in the 14th congressional district, the state's largely rural northwest corner, was to fill the vacancy created by the resignation of Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, the fascist advocate of conspiracy theories who fell out with Trump over foreign policy, particularly the U.S. war with Iran. A March 10th primary left Democrat Sean Harris, a retired Army general who was African-American, competing with Republican Clay Fuller, a local district attorney. Fuller won the runoff election with 56% of the vote, compared to 44% for Harris. The 12-point margin was down sharply from 2024, when Greene defeated Sean Harris by 29 percentage points, and Trump defeated Kamala Harris by 37 points. Even more significant was the collapse in voter turnout, which fell from nearly 300,000 to just over 130,000. The Georgia result showed the largest swing against the Republicans of any special election since Trump took office. Such a double-digit swing to the Democrats, if it were to materialize on Election Day this year, would sweep an estimated 80 Republican House members out of office, and would cost the Republicans control of the Senate as well. All told, Democrats have captured 30 Republican seats in state legislatures and other off-year contests, while the Republicans have not captured a single Democratic seat. This pattern shows the mounting popular hostility to the Trump administration, albeit distorted and constrained by the reactionary anti-democratic structure of the two-party system, with both parties committed to the defense of the financial oligarchy and the capitalist system. Recognizing the popular growing opposition to his administration, Trump issued an executive order last month to curb mail-in voting and give the U.S. Postal Service, whose board he appoints, the authority to reject state mail ballots that do not meet his security prescriptions. He instructed the Department of Homeland Security and the Social Security Administration to prepare a master list of eligible voters and impose it on the states, in defiance of the U.S. Constitution, which gives states the primary role in election administration and provides no role for the federal executive. The White House is pushing for congressional approval of the Save America Act, which would make it mandatory for prospective voters to show proof of citizenship when they register and to show government-issued ID when they come to the polls. Both the bill and executive order are premised on the lies that millions of non-citizens are voting in U.S. elections, and that Trump's defeat in 2020 was the result of this voting by illegal aliens. In an appearance on the Rachel Maddow Show on Monday night, Democratic Senator Mark Warner of Virginia declared, quote, "I am terrified that this administration is going to try to create some incident that can allow federal intervention," unquote. Warner, the senior Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, is well informed on the operations of the U.S. national security apparatus. He suggested that Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard was playing a major role in an effort to declare that foreign actors were interfering in the U.S. elections, making it necessary to mobilize federal troops at polling stations. He pointed to Gabbard's presence during an FBI raid on election offices in Atlanta, Georgia, and in seizing voting machines in Puerto Rico, actions that would not normally concern a cabinet official with responsibility for overseeing U.S. intelligence gathering overseas. Warner continued, quote, "The idea that they would pick some threat, real or conceived, to use as an excuse, I think we have to be very conscious of. So I've been trying to meet with former military leaders, intelligence leaders, law enforcement, just to say, you know, if you see something that comes out that's a crock, speak up and rebut. And the press, frankly, needs to do it as well. This is about the heart of our democracy, whether it's going to be free and fair elections," unquote. For all their professions of concern, however, neither Warner nor any other leading Democrat has called for action to defend the right to vote or to oppose Trump's efforts to rig the elections. They are far more afraid of a popular movement against Trump's drives towards dictatorship than anything that Trump himself might do. Iran war shock causes IMF to revise down global growth forecast, by Nick Beams. The U.S. war on Iran has caused the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, to revise down its forecast for global growth, which will be released at its spring meeting next week. In an interview with Bloomberg on Tuesday, IMF head Kristalina Georgieva said the world was ill-equipped to deal with the economic shock generated by the war. She said that before the U.S. war, quote, "We were on the way of upgrading our growth projections for 2026. Given the impact of the war, we are going to downgrade them," unquote. The choking of oil supplies has triggered, quote, "a negative supply shock," meaning that it pushes prices up. And, quote, "therefore attention to inflation ought to be a priority." As is always the case with the financial institutions of global capitalism, attention to inflation does not mean developing means to bring prices down. The focus is ensuring that any significant wage movement of the working class in response to increasingly intolerable price hikes will be countered by raising interest rates. She said the world was less prepared to meet a major economic downturn than before and armed with less policy tools. This was due to two factors. First, great power tensions and conflicts had made international cooperation more difficult in the face of an emergency, even as those same conflicts had made them more frequent. This assessment is underscored by the fact that this is the second consecutive spring meeting in which the IMF has confronted an emergency provoked by the actions of the Trump administration. In 2025, the spring meeting was held as Trump unveiled his so-called reciprocal tariffs against the rest of the world, effectively shattering the post-war international trading framework. This year's meeting is being held in the shadow of the U.S. war on Iran. The second factor was the growth of government debt. Georgieva said, quote, "The world is facing this shock after it has been sustaining the impact of COVID, of the war in Ukraine, in other words, with depleted policy space," unquote, noting that few governments had taken any meaningful measures to pay down their post-COVID debt pile. The other factor, which she chose not to mention in deference to the IMF's political masters, the major imperialist powers, is the increase in military spending by governments around the world. This is spending which is to be paid for by cuts to social services, health, and education, on the grounds that the constriction of policy space makes this unnecessary. She said central banks had to balance attention to inflation with concern about not suffocating growth. Quote, "Be very careful how you respond to the shock. It's a very delicate moment," unquote. An IMF blog post issued at the end of last month summarized some of the effects of the war that had already, quote, caused serious disruption to the economies of the most directly affected countries, including damage to their infrastructure and industries that could become long-lasting. Quote, parts of the Middle East, Africa, Asia-Pacific, and Latin America face the added strains of higher food and fertilizer prices and tighter financial conditions. Low-income countries are especially at risk of food insecurity. Some may need external support, even as such assistance has been declining. The blog post said that while the war could shape parts of the global economy in different ways, quote, all roads lead to higher prices and slower growth. Apart from the effect of higher energy prices, the war is impacting supply chains for non-energy production inputs. Quote, rerouting tankers and container ships raises freight and insurance costs and lengthens delivery time. Air traffic disruptions around key Gulf hubs impacts global tourism while adding another layer of complexity to trade, unquote. The war, it said, had, quote, unsettled financial markets, unquote, with a decline in stock prices and a rise in bond yields across the major economies. While the market sell-off so far had been contained, at least compared to past global shocks, financial conditions had nonetheless tightened worldwide. But this relatively sanguine outlook on financial conditions may not last because, as Financial Times columnist Ruchir Sharma pointed out in a recent comment, the oil shock had revealed, quote, novel reality in the global economy. He wrote, quote, never before has the world entered a crisis of any kind with such high deficits and debt levels. This burden will limit the ability of governments to cushion the impact of higher energy prices. He noted that since the first oil shock at the beginning of the 1970s, the typical budget deficit of major economies in relation to GDP has more than doubled from 2%, and the total government debt level for the G7 countries has gone from 20% to more than 100% of GDP. He wrote, quote, last year, driven by government borrowing, total global debt levels rose at the fastest pace since the pandemic surge to a record $348 trillion, which is more than three times global GDP. That leaves very few governments in a position to roll out a new stimulus. While the U.S. had energy self-sufficiency, it was, quote, nonetheless vulnerable to a prolonged conflict because it has the highest deficit in the developed world last year at nearly 6% of GDP, unquote. With interest payments on U.S. government debt now exceeding even spending on the military, the bond market reaction to the oil price shock was a rise in yields. This was sending out a warning as the administration habituated to spending as if there is no limit, increased military outlays by $1.5 trillion. Combined with tax breaks and other decisions, this could lift the deficit close to 7% of GDP this year. Sharma concluded his piece with the observation that any protracted increase in oil prices, quote, is likely to be magnified by the fact that governments are running low on policy ammunition to counter it, and this new vulnerability will expose the global economy not only to fallout from the Iran war, but to every shock in the foreseeable future, unquote. Besides the quantum of government debt, there is also the issue of who holds it and how it is being financed. In a recent comment, Financial Times columnist Gillian Tett drew attention to significant research carried out by the New York Federal Reserve last October into the so-called basis trade in U.S. Treasuries. This is the process by which hedge funds and others exploit the tiny differences between the future price of treasuries and the cash price of the bonds. Because the difference is so small, large amounts of leverage are needed to make substantial profit. The result has been a transformation in the structure of the $30 trillion treasury market, the basis of the global financial system, over the past 4 years. As Tett drew out in her report, the Cayman Islands, the home of 85% of hedge funds, located there for tax minimization purposes, is, quote, the largest foreign holder of U.S. Treasury securities, holding significantly more than China, Japan, and the United Kingdom. The Fed economists found that between 2022 and 2024, hedge funds, quote, absorbed 37% of net issuance of bonds and notes. And this was nearly the same amount as all other foreign investors combined. These funds operate according to similar algorithms, which means that in the event of a market shock, they tend to react in the same way, creating the conditions for a rush for the exits in a financial crisis. Thus, as concerns grow over the growth of debt in the face of the shock to the global economy resulting from the war, whatever the outcome of the present ceasefire negotiations, the Treasury market, which finances this debt, is being turned into a giant casino. This has been Paul Fuller for the World Socialist Website.
The World Socialist Website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist Website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.